Good afternoon. So last time we sort of went over sort of actually using multiple threads through the pthreads interface, we looked at, well, how can we pass values to and from threads? Our first examples kind of just have all these global variables, and that's not really something you want to do in sort of actual, you know, quote unquote, real code. So we wanted to have, you know, ways where we could sort of pass things dynamically, have things be on the heap if we wanted them to be, and we showed how to do that. We also talked about, well, threads have resources associated with them, so obviously we have a stack, and we also need some bookkeeping because our join operation lets us collect the thread's return value. And sometimes we don't want to do that, and one option for dealing with that is, well, we have to join anyways, even if we don't care about the return value. Another option we have is that we can mark the threads as detached, which basically means that when they exit, the threading library knows, oh, you don't care about the return value, I can just clean up the thread right away. Then we started talking about race conditions and interleaving. We're going to spend most of today talking about topics related to that. And we talked about how, you know, because our two threads are executing simultaneously, even on a single core, we're going to have cases where the results are effectively random. They aren't really random, but they sort of depend on all sorts of things about what's going on around in the system, because it depends on exactly when the OS decides to run one thread versus the other. And with multiple cores, this problem kind of gets worse, because we can have two different cores trying to do things, and it turns out that even individual instructions are done in separate steps, so you can have interleaving of the steps of individual instructions that cause us to get interesting results. And so a concern we were starting to worry about is what operations are what we call atomic. What operations actually occur sort of all at once, or not, you know, where we don't have these intermediate steps where we, you know, can see these weird results from, you know, the different relative ordering of those steps in two different threads. And when we finished up last time, we kind of looked at our example of this loop with a bunch of ads and found out, oh, wait, this, you know, the ad is not atomic, and we can see that in that we don't get the result of 2 million ads, we get something else because they're interleaved steps to do the ad. The ad, even though it's one instruction, still involves loading values, doing an ad, and storing values, and those things can happen, you know, separately from each other and be interleaved with the other thread's version of those operations. And we said, okay, well, that means that we need to know it's actually atomic, and happily, our processor designers will document for us that some instructions are atomic and some aren't. And we're going to look at sort of a little bit at, you know, some things where this maybe helps us less than we'd like. And then we'll talk about our practical solution, which is going to be that we're going to use things our threading library provides when we actually want to coordinate threads. And they're going to deal with figuring out what is the documentation of the processor designer actually let us do. Before I move on to that, questions about things we covered last time? Any questions? Things we covered last time? Okay, so nothing immediately. Okay. And when we finished up last time, we were looking at this piece of code. So here, I've done something kind of maybe similar to what you did in your signals lab. You said, okay, well, I want to check something that's kind of executing separately from this code if it becomes ready. So what I'll do is I'll have a global variable called ready, and we'll set that when it becomes ready. And I just want to wait until something becomes ready. So I'll just have a loop that just waits and keeps checking if it's ready. And my compiler here said, okay, well, so to execute this loop, first, I want to put things in registers, so I'm going to copy the ready variable into a register for you. And gosh, you know, I don't need to do that over and over again, right? Because it's the same variable. There's nothing here which changes it. So the compiler says, okay, the naive thing to do would be to have sort of our loop move ready to EAX and then test it, test EAX. But the compiler said, I don't need to load ready every time. I can just load it before the loop, and we know it doesn't change because there's no code that changes ready here. So why would it change? Don't need to keep doing that. So the compiler has decided to move all the loads of ready before the loop and consolidated them into this one move instruction. And this is, according to the C standard, a 100% legitimate way to compile this. Completely allowed. There's no rules that the compiler is breaking, and this is actually what compilers will do if you ask for them to do any optimization. And what's going on here is that the people writing the C standard have said, we don't want compilers to look at every single piece of code and worry about what if another thread's executing here. So they don't have to. The compiler is allowed to read your code and say, all the stuff that modifies the variables I'm seeing here is in this code. If I don't see something modifying ready, I'm not like calling a system call that might modify it or, doing something like that. Don't need to assume it changes. And that's really useful because most of the time we want the compiler to make optimizations where we don't like keep loading something from memory into a register. And it would be really challenging for the compiler to do those optimizations if it had to worry in every single piece of code, what if another thread modifies this global variable? Another way that this manifests, you can see here. So here we have the same problem. We have our loop, which is the same loop, checking other ready here. And we've decided to do this thing where we say, well, I want to inform the other thread I'm waiting for it. So the way I'll do that is I'll have this global is waiting variable. I'll set it to 1 when I'm waiting, 0 when I'm not waiting. And the compiler looked at this code and said, okay, so what you're doing here is you're setting is waiting to 1, and then you're setting is waiting to 0. And you aren't really using the is waiting equals 1. So that's what's commonly known in compiler parlance as a dead store. It doesn't do anything. And we can get rid of it. It doesn't do anything. There's no use of is waiting. Like this function needs to set is waiting to 0 before it returns. Like that's how it works. But there's nothing that uses is waiting equals 1. Because again, the compiler doesn't need to worry about your other threads. So the compiler here has said, okay, well, we're going to have the move of 0 into is waiting, but we just got rid of the move of 1 because it wasn't needed. It didn't do anything. It's going to be set to 0 anyways. Why bother setting something to 0 and then setting something to 1 and then setting it to 0? We can just set it to 0. It's a faster way of doing that. So this sort of choice by the C standard and compilers to try to assume your code doesn't have other threads going on seems a bit inconvenient, and it is. And you might say, well, of course, there must be a way to tell the compiler not to do this. And absolutely there is, and I can talk about that some other time if you talk to me after class or something, but that's not the solution we're going to use. And one reason for that is that even when you do that, even when you tell the compiler, you add something to tell the compiler, assume this value is being modified from other threads, it's still not enough. And that's because processors also do this. They also do this trick where they say, you're reading this variable, we could read that a little earlier, and that should be fine. Or you're writing, so like the example here, some processors will say, oh, you're writing is waiting equals 1. We don't need to have that write finish before you start waiting. That's fine. So the processors do some of this kind of trick where they'll say, move around the loads and stores relative to other things to speed things up. Because kind of the guarantee they're giving you is not that each instruction executes and then the next instruction executes. The guarantee they're giving you is that it kind of works correctly when you think of what each thread does. And if you want to coordinate each thread, you need to do something special in several cases. Not all the time, but there's specific cases where you're going to need some special instructions to tell the processor what's going on. Now, we're not going to write any of those instructions. So what are we going to do? Well, we're using a threading library. And one of the things the threading library is going to do is it's going to handle all these compiler and processor issues for us. So as long as we can use the threading library's way of coordinating between threads, we're fine. Those functions will handle telling the processor, don't move things around, and telling the compiler, hey, there's another thread going on here, don't do these tricks with global variables. Assume any global variables being modified from some other thread when you see this happening. So examples of functions we've seen which do that is pthread create and pthread join. So pthread join will properly say, tell the compiler, hey, you know, when we're calling pthread join, that means something is using all those global variables because there's another thread we're waiting for. And we call pthread create the same kind of thing. It says, you know, you better make sure that if I set is waiting to one and I call pthread create, that is waiting is actually set to one because this thread I'm creating might notice it. So pthreads will handle giving all those hints to the compiler and the processor. So for the compiler, there's going to be some compiler specific directives sometimes to indicate, really don't move things around here. You know, assume other threads are going on. And for the processor, often there will be these special instructions. So in x86, probably the simplest example of this is there's an instruction called mFence, which is short for memory fence. And the reason this is called a fence is we can kind of think of having a bunch of sort of load, store, load, and we have our fence. And a bunch of load and stores. And without the fence, what can happen is that the processor is allowed to move the loads around a little bit, as long as you can't notice in a single thread. And the same thing with the stores. But the fence says the processor can't move them through the fence. So everything before the fence will happen before everything after the fence. And this is kind of what we want for something like pthread join and threads exiting, right? Where we want to make sure when a thread exits, all of its operations happen before you join it. So you see everything the thread did by the time it's joined. There's no funny stuff going on where, you know, something decided that, oh, the thread sets its waiting, but no one reads that value for a while. No, it's going to be set when it exits, and we're going to use an mFence to enforce that in the processor level, and we're going to use some hints to the compiler to enforce that at the compiler level. So questions about this idea of sort of reordering, moving around, and consolidating memory accesses? Yeah?
So the only way you can ensure that the instructions are run in order is to just have like an mFence up every line?
Question, the only way we can ensure instructions are run in order is to have an mFence up every line? So x86 does have rules that restrict when reordering happens. And so in addition to there being other instructions that act like mFence, there are some instructions which are like ordered correctly by default. But as for figuring out when that is, you need to look carefully at the documentation. But I would say like x86 actually does pretty close to what you expect without mFence instructions, but there's just a few corner cases where you need instructions like mFence. There's some other architectures which are much worse at doing something close to what you'd expect without instructions like mFence than x86. x86 has only a few little cases where the processor is allowed to do like really non-intuitive things about like changing when stores and loads happen versus other architectures. But there are a few cases, and for those you need to use something like mFence. And in fact, if you look at like how pthread join is implemented, it's going to run an instruction that has an effect similar to that. Maybe not mFence literally, but some similar instruction. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So we talked about sort of other tools here, and we're going to talk about kind of our main other tool. And the reason we want another tool is that the tools we have so far are like create, join, and those only work when we're starting and stopping a thread. And we want to coordinate things in the middle of threads running. And to talk about that, first I'm going to talk about some definitions. And I'm going to talk about these definitions partly because one of these definitions is going to be the name of the next tool we're going to have, and partly because these terms are used all over the place, so people will expect you to know them. So one concept we're going to have is something called mutual exclusion, that one thread does a particular thing at a time. So ensuring that typically this means like only one thread accesses some resource, like an account balance, for example, at a time. So mutual exclusion is kind of the insurance of that taking turns. And we're going to have code where we enforce that mutual exclusion property, only one thread at a time. We will call that code a critical section. So if you hear the term critical section, that's code where we have mutual exclusion. And we're going to have an abstraction for enforcing mutual exclusion, which we're going to call unlock. And a lock is an object that we say threads can hold, and only one thread can hold it at a time. And this is an interface that kind of is going to let us create mutual exclusion. And you might say, okay, so we're talking about locks, so clearly we're going to have some analogies with like padlocks, and I am deliberately avoiding that. And the reason I'm avoiding that is that there's this kind of common misconception about locks I'd like to get out, which is kind of that if we think of a padlock, right, you can't just ignore a padlock. But the lock abstraction is kind of poorly named in that you can just ignore it. And in fact, this is a very common source of bugs. So a lock is kind of more like, you know, you might know a talking stick, and I'll use the analogy of, for maximum silliness, is that we'll reference it to a hat. And we're going to have a silly agreement that I'm managing a bank, I have some account balances, and to make sure that all our account balances are managed properly, we're going to have a rule that in order to change the account balances, you need to put on the hat. Normally, the hat's going to be on the table, and inherently, only one thread at a time can have the hat. And we'll just have this rule that you put that on before you ever touch the account balances, and you take it off when you're done. And that's going to be like our lock. So to protect our account balances, we'll impose that rule, and we're going to have a lock operation or acquire operation, which is putting on the hat, an unlock or release operation, which is putting down the hat. And the reason this is going to work is because we follow this agreement. If I slip and start editing account balances without taking the hat, well, we've lost. You know, it's just not going to work. And that's like the big thing I want to point out, because that's a very common bug, that if you have a lock for something, it doesn't get used automatically. You have to actually follow your agreement about we get the lock, we put on the hat before we do this. If you don't do that, the compiler's not going to stop you. You're just going to have a race condition. So typically, for one of these locks, you know, we're going to sort of associate it with a shared resource, and we have these two operations. We have the acquire or lock operation, which is going to wait until the lock is free. So if someone else has the hat and it's not on the table, I'm just going to stand here and wait for it to be put down for me to get it. And we have the release operation where we put it back down and someone else can grab it at that time. Who gets it first depends on how the lock is implemented, if more than one person thread is waiting. And typically the way we'll use this is we'll have an agreement that there's some shared resource, like an account balance or something like that, or a file, and everyone acquires the lock before they do anything with it and releases the lock when they're done. So if we think of our bank account code, we'll have a lock for each account, for example, and before we edit the balance in any way, we'll acquire the lock. After we're done editing it, we'll release the lock. So take turns manipulating the balance. So questions about what our lock provides. And I guess one thing I want to emphasize is that the acquire operation, and this will have many consequences later, is a waiting operation. So if we acquire the lock, we just wait until it's available. We're not gonna decide, if the lock isn't available, we're just gonna wait. We're not going to say, oh, well, it's kind of available, let's just keep going. No, we just wait. So if we're doing that waiting, in our ideal lock implementations, the way this is going to work is that we're going to have some coordination with the operating system, and that there'll be some way that when we wait for a lock, we'll notify the OS, hey, I can't do anything right now, why don't you run something else? And the OS will somehow know back to switch back to us when the lock should be available. So this is what the locks that we're going to see in the pthreads library are going to do. And it's kind of the locks you typically want to use. Now, there's another sort of the non-ideal lock, but much easier to implement. Is a spin lock where we don't do this. Where while we're waiting for the lock, the way the wait works is we basically keep checking, is the lock available? Is the lock available? Is the lock available? And use a processor to do that. So that's probably not something you should usually do, but that's the simplest way to implement locks and sometimes is involved in the sort of low-level code for implementing the locks. They'll have some cases where that happens. So we have these locks that are gonna be mostly this type of lock where when we wait for the lock, as long as we're not waiting for a very short time, we're gonna give up the processor, let other things run. And the type of the lock interface that the pthreads library provides, it actually provides a couple locks, but the one that we are gonna primarily recommend are called mutexes. So mutex being short for mutual exclusion. And they have a lock and an lock operation. They have an init operation, and there's mutex attributes. You can look up that you can actually configure these mutexes to work in slightly different ways than the default. That's why that argument is there. So questions? Lock interface? Okay, so let's do a little exercise here. So I have, let's say we're running thread A and thread B at the same time, and my question here is what are the final possible values of the variables 1 and 2? And I will write out kind of our possibilities. Not all of these may be actually possible, but like sort of all the combinations. We can have 1 be thread A, and 2 be from thread A. We can have 1 be from thread A, and 2 be from thread B. We can have 1 be from thread B, and 2 be from thread A. And we can have both of them be from thread B, where I'm using TA indicates, the value from thread A, and TB indicates, one of the values from the thread B code. Question, yes. So question, if two threads go for a lock at the same time, is there a specific choice that's made? That is up to the lock implementation with pthread mutex. It is, it's not random, but as far as you can tell, there's no rhyme or reason behind it. It's whatever's, it's probably implemented as whatever's fastest for the OS to implement. So I'll give you a bit of time. You can check with your neighbors which of these four possibilities can actually happen. Is there a question?
Yeah, is it guaranteed that the variable will be changed by the time we unlock it?
Question, is it guaranteed that the variable will be changed by the time we unlock it? As in, like, the write will actually write to the one or two global variable? With the unlock, yes, and that is one of the things that I said, you know, happens with pthreads, you know, giving the correct hints to the compiler and to the processor. It will do that to make sure the, you know, compiler doesn't do anything like say, oh, I can write two at the end of the function because it doesn't matter. No, the unlock will say you can't do that. Does that answer your question? Would like some more time? Okay, a few people. Okay, so let's start with our first possibility, which is having both 1 and 2 be the value set by thread A. Who thinks that this is something that could happen? Who thinks this is something that could not happen? And no clue. A few no clues. So this is something which can happen, and this is actually, this and the last case are the easiest to explain. How can we make this happen? Let's have the way that these run, even though we start the thread simultaneously, let's say thread A gets stalled. So thread A, you know, gets stalled and then runs everything. And thread B doesn't get stalled, so it runs everything first. So in that case, we'll run the two assignments in thread A. After all the assignments in thread B, I should make it so you can see which thread is which. And as for the locks, you know, with this ordering, at no point is thread A waiting for thread B. So there's not, or vice versa, because, you know, they are happening one at a time just by happenstance. So that's a way we can get this scenario to happen, and we can kind of invert this. We can have thread B be stalled and thread A run right away to have our last scenario happen. So the first and last are both possible. The simplest way to cause them to happen is just to say that thread A runs, then thread B, or thread B runs, and then thread A. We could also have some interleavings. So if thread B runs first, and thread A starts running in the middle of it, it's going to wait for this lock one, and it's going to wait until thread B is finished doing all its assignments. So that's another way we could have the thread A values win, that if thread B gets the lock one before thread A starts running, that's sufficient to ensure that thread A does its assignments last. Questions on sort of why I think the first and last possibility can happen? Okay, so the other ones are harder because for them to be possible, they all involve something where we aren't just doing one and the other, clearly. So who thinks we can have one be the value set by thread A and two be the value set by thread B? A few people. Who thinks that's not possible? Okay. So our consensus is, and we'll go over this later, is that this is not possible, or not a consensus, but majority. Okay. And how about a remaining possibility that we can have one be the value set by thread B and two be the value set by thread A? Who thinks that's possible? Who thinks that's not possible? No clue. Okay. So I have worked out kind of that B coming from thread one is possible with A coming from thread two, and the way we can have that happen is that we can have, should have this, is that thread A can lock one and then set A1 and unlock lock one. Then thread B can run in its entirety, and then thread A can run. And here, we have no point where we have to worry about contended locks, you know, with this order. We could also have the same thing happen where A locks lock one, and sets A1, lock one, and then thread B comes along, and it tries to lock one, but it has to wait until thread one unlocks it. So this lock of one finishes later. So that's another possibility. But in either case, we can end up having thread B run all its code that uses lock one, this whole block here, be run in between these two pieces of code. Either because kind of that just naturally happens, or because thread B tries to acquire lock one while thread A is running, and that acquire can't finish until thread A releases lock one. So that's why we can have B thread B's have value one and thread A have value two. The other way around isn't possible, because we would need to run B1 after A1 and before A2. So we would need to squeeze B1 in here. So for that to happen, we need to acquire lock one here and then I have that right? B2. Yeah, we need to squeeze that in there and then not have. Did I do this wrong? B1 after A1 before. A2. Oh, right. Yeah. So if we run, if we fish this in here, we're going to have B1, B2 here. Or do we? No. I did this wrong here. V2. Is that actually V1 to run after? Yeah, so we need to have this here and this here. And okay, now that should be, I don't know why I write my slides this way. So what we want to happen is thread A, we lock one, we run A1, we unlock one, right? So that's what the order we're trying to get. And thread B, we're going to lock one, and we're going to set B1, run B1. And then thread A is going to lock two, run A2, unlock two, while thread B tries to lock two. And then we're going to run B2 and unlock two and unlock one. So that would be how that we could do that. Okay, so questions on that, and I don't know, should think of my slides quicker. So that's the, yeah, this gives us a final B1, oh, I see what I, sorry. That gives us B1, B2, sorry, as the final. We want, I see, yeah, so that gives us B1, B2, but we wanted, right, we want, sorry, that's what I forgot, we want A1 to win. So we want B1 to happen here, sorry, that's why my slide was wrong. So that I showed you why the other possibility, but here we have B1 up here and B2 here, right? This is what we want in order to get a final result of 1, 2 equals sort of from A and from B. So in order for that to happen, this code needs to run after, this one code needs to run before the A code, and the other code, the B2 code, needs to run after the A2 code. So we need to have kind of the whole operation here sandwiched in between. And that's not possible because we would need, because we have to hold lock one here. Lock one is never released. So we can't run this piece of code here where we have lock one. This cannot run in between these two things. And we would need that to happen in order to get our A1, B2 results. Sorry for, I hopefully didn't confuse people too much on that. Yes, not planning things. A1, B2, need to run B2 before one, before A2, before B2. There we go. That's the error I made on my screen. That confused me. Okay. Questions on this exercise? Sorry for. So for time reasons, I won't be going over these, but we have a few other examples you can go through. Basically, the strategy for solving the, for like looking at this is like, we want to consider interleavings, right? And you just want to look at, can I run this in the middle of something? The question is like, am I getting locks I can't get? Like that's what's going to restrict our ordering. And in this case, you know, we had our, what we could do here, or what we could do here, right, was restricted by lock one, right? We can't acquire lock one in the middle of there. That is not possible to do. Therefore, the assignment to A1 can't squeeze in between the two B assignments. Questions? Here. Okay. So we've introduced new texts and gone over kind of their basic, you know, usage and, you know, pointed out sort of how we can try to reason about interleavings. This is kind of tedious. We're not going to have you do it all the time, maybe a little bit, but you know, it's kind of tedious. But the main reason why we're going to use mutexes is we're going to have this kind of logic, you know, that we have some shared resource being prevented, and that's how we're going to know our code is safe or not safe. So one thing about mutexes is that some of you might get this clever idea that I can use mutexes as a way of communicating between threads beyond whether something's available, because, you know, the way lock works, you know, so the way unlock works is it lets someone who's waiting on lock go. So I can kind of use mutex to signal another thread, you know. And you might have these clever ideas. Peeper and mutexes have a rule that you have to unlock from the same thread you lock in. So please do not try to use mutexes in for clever ways. And this sometimes will matter and sometimes won't. But the reason I'm mentioning this is that you might say, well, I want to do some other sorts of coordination between threads. Like, for example, you know, I want to wait for something to happen in one thread and another thread. And pthread mutexes, because of that unlock restriction, definitely don't really do that. And we're going to talk about, probably next week, some better tools for solving that problem. So given that I've told you this, you might say, well, I have another way of using mutexes to wait for another thread, and there is something here that is functional, but a bad idea. You might say, well, you told me that pthread mutex lock and unlock handle all those reordering problems, so let's just do our while not ready loop with pthread mutex locks. And yes, this will work. This is very wasteful of processor time, and we also have an issue that it's very possible for this code to sort of wait for a very long time, because often what will happen is that the thread that's doing the repeated lock and unlock and then lock will always get the lock first before the other thread waiting for it. Not guaranteed, but often that's how the lock will work, is that whoever tries to start acquiring it right immediately after is more likely to get it than someone who tried to start acquiring it a while ago. So don't do this, and we will have better solutions to solve this problem in next week. Okay, so for our last half hour, we're going to talk about a particular problem with locks, which we're going to call deadlock. And to illustrate that, I'm going to use kind of a real-world example. So let's say we have a one-lane bridge here, and we have two drivers, and we're going to use kind of lock-like way of thinking about the world. We're going to acquire a lock on our resources. So we're going to say, okay, let's look at the piece of road in front of me. That little piece of road is free. I'm going to claim ownership of it and drive my car there. Great. Now let's repeat that procedure. We look at the piece of road in front of us. That piece of road isn't free. I'm going to wait for it to be free. And if we just do that, we're just going to be waiting for a long time. So if we're stubborn, we're going to wait forever. And if you recall my definition of the acquire operation, lock is wait for lock to be released. You know, then, right, it waits for the lock to be free. It doesn't wait, you know, 10 minutes for the lock to be free. It waits for the lock to be free indefinitely. So our acquire operation is super stubborn. So you might say, in the real world, well, we have better solutions to this problem. So in the real world, probably one of these drivers is going to chicken out and back up. In the real world, we might like set up a traffic light over here and here. we might have some other solution, but if we want to solve the equivalent problem with locks, that we'll see examples of like how this will occur kind of naturally in your code, we're going to need to implement one of those solutions. What acquire and release or lock and unlock do doesn't, it does the stubborn driver thing and it's just going to wait forever. So this is my very synthetic example, but this happens sort of all the time with natural code. So here I'm saying, let's say we have some code to move a file from one directory to another. And in my implementation of apparently an OS, I've decided I'm representing directories. I'm going to have a lock for each directory because we don't want two different threads to be manipulating the files in a directory in an uncoordinated way. And we'll have like a hash table of directory entries. And what my move file operation is going to do is first I'm going to acquire the locks in both the directory we're moving from and the directory we're moving to. And then I'm going to remove an entry from one directory, put it in another. And I'm doing this with the locks held so we don't have like weird situations where someone tries to modify the file while we're trying to move it and something bad happens, and the file, the file pointer becomes invalid or something like that. We're preventing that here. And this is kind of the most natural way probably to write this code if we have these locks for each directory. And here I have two calls to move file that we could run simultaneously. And these are like logically independent calls. Yes, they both work on the same two directories, but moving a file foo from one directory to another and moving a file bar from the other directory to the first one, that's what we're doing. We're moving foo from A to B, bar from B to A. Right? These are logically independent operations that shouldn't interfere with each other. And what makes the deadlock problem really annoying is that most of the time, they won't. Most of the time, something like this will happen. They won't combine the moves at exactly the same time. So one thread will get all the locks and release them. Then the other thread goes. Or maybe we run them at closer to the same time, but it's still fine. Thread A gets the lock on A, then gets the lock on B, then thread B is running, but it's still fine because it tries to get the lock on B, it just needs to wait until thread A releases it, then it gets to go. Everything's fine. But every once in a while, one in a thousand times, they run at just the right times. And thread A is going to lock A, thread B is going to lock B, then thread 1 is going to lock B, and thread 2 is going to try to lock A. And neither of these second locks are going to work. Thread 1 can't lock B until thread 2 unlocks it. Well, that's fine. We just need to wait for thread 2 to be done. So let's look at what thread 2 is doing. Well, thread 2 is trying to lock A, which is not going to happen until thread 1 unlocks it. So we're stuck at that standstill. And in our code, our two drivers, thread 1 and thread 2, are stubborn. They're not going to give up. They're just going to keep waiting. And so we'll just hang there forever. And making this wonderful to debug, this will happen like 1 out of 10,000 times. When you're moving files in just the right way, the system will hang. Rest of the time, it's fine. So questions on sort of why this results in a hang? Or other things about this scenario? Okay, so one way we can visualize this is that I can kind of draw a graph if you're taking DSA2 in the DSA2 sense, like an extension of a tree, we'll draw this picture where I have sort of things for each thread and things for each resource, and I draw an arrow from a thread to a resource if we're waiting for it, and from a resource to a thread if the thread has ownership of that resource meaning that that thread needs to release the resource before someone else can use it. And when we have one of these deadlock situations, we're going to have a cycle, a loop, in this picture. So we can see here, thread one, lock thread A, lock directory A, and it's waiting for the lock for directory B. Thread two, lock directory B, and it's waiting for the lock for directory A, and that forms our loop. That loop is necessary for us to have this sort of stalling condition. And one of the reasons I'm showing you this diagram is that this kind of suggests kind of naturally that, well, you know, you drew a loop with four things, but we could have more things in the loop. So we could have three or four, or, you know, six or eight or 10 or 12 things in the loop. So we could have, you know, thread one is locked A and is waiting for B. Thread two locked B and is waiting for C. Thread three locked C and is waiting for A. So in this case, we have the same sort of stalling situation, and no two threads have anything in common with each other. Have more than one thing in common with each other. It's all three of them need to be around for us to have this hanging bug. So this is even more fun to, if you're tasked with, hey, our customer has this problem where the system hangs, reproduce it, please. Problem. This is kind of a picture of the same timeline for that situation. Okay, and I've shown this deadlock situation with locks, but it can also happen with other resources. So let's say I have a system with a bunch of memory, and I decide I don't like malloc because malloc makes me crash my program when I'm out of memory. But I know, we only use memory in short bursts. So why don't I replace malloc with this allocate and wait function? It's going to allocate or wait function. It's going to allocate that much memory, or if that memory isn't available, it's going to wait around until it is. Seems like a fine idea. If I do that, now I can have this deadlock between these two scenarios. If I have, say, for example, if I had 2 meg of space, each of these threads could run independently. That's not a problem. We have 2 meg of memory, we can allocate 2 meg. And it seems like this allocate or wait idea should help us out because, we'll run one and then the other one will wait to they'll take turns. But because I'm kind of allocating in two chunks, what can happen is thread one allocates a megabyte, then waits for the next megabyte. Thread two, in the meanwhile, thread two is allocated its first megabyte and is waiting for its second. And if there's only 2 meg available, neither of them are ever going to get it unless this allocator wait gives up in some way. And I can kind of represent that, as another kind of graph. In this case, I've done a different notation, but, I could have also done the same kind of picture, the first meg, the second meg. But we can kind of generalize this to divisible resources. And like with our, other deadlock, right, this is the bad case, but I could deploy this code and most of the time I'd get the, nice case. And things would seem to work fine. So there's another very artificial example of deadlock we'll give you, which is going to be the subject of the lab. So in the next week's lab, we want you to explore solving solutions for deadlock, which we're going to talk about in our last 20 minutes and or next time. And we're going to apply them to this artificial scenario called the dining philosopher's problem, which was thought up in the 60s as kind of a way to illustrate kind of the deadlock problem, in kind of its most sort of complex and interesting form. And this is kind of a thought experiment that we're going to have kind of represent in the lab. So in the dining philosopher's problem, we have 5 philosophers sitting around a table, and the philosophers are eating a meal using chopsticks. and we have five chopsticks on the table, right? Five floss, five chopsticks. And we're gonna follow this procedure for when philosopher wants to eat. They're gonna grab the chopstick on their left, then grab the chopstick on their right, and then eat, and then put the chopsticks down. So the deadlock here is if everyone grabs their chopstick on their left at the same time, and then they look for the chopstick on the right, well, everyone's waiting for each other. And kind of our assumption in this problem is that, you know, all the philosophers are nice and polite. They're not gonna like demand someone give up their chopstick. And they're just gonna keep waiting. And this is our deadlock. We're stalled, you know, indefinitely, unless, you know, someone is not actually stubborn. And unlike our sort of bridge example, like this is a deadlock where you can obviously have arbitrarily many things involved in many threads involved in the deadlock. So, questions on the dining philosopher scenario. So in the lab, we're gonna represent each of the chopsticks with a block out of it. So let me sort of more formally define deadlock. And the reason I'm gonna do that is because this is gonna help us figure out how can we avoid deadlock. Because deadlock is like basic, a really annoying problem to just debug, we're gonna want to proactively design our program so it can't happen. So to do that, we're going to think about what does it mean for it to happen? And kind of semi-formally, it's circular waiting for resources. And we mentioned that the resource, often it's a lock, but it can be any sort of resource that a thread needs to do work. And usually it's non-deterministic, right? The deadlock will sometimes happen and sometimes not happen, and that's what makes it something we're going to really want to avoid. And we can kind of formalize what do we need to have in for deadlock to these four requirements, which we need all of them to be held true, or we don't have a deadlock. So one requirement we need is we need some sort of mutual exclusion. If every thread can use whatever resource we have, we don't have something that's like a lock where only one thread can have it at a time, there's no deadlock. So an example of this with our allocated weight, if we have infinite memory, there's no mutual exclusion for the memory resource, so the allocator weight wouldn't matter. Wouldn't have deadlock anymore. We need to have the hold and wait property, that one thread needs to hold some resources so another thread can't use it while acquiring another resource. So this means in our allocator weight example, the problem was we got some memory, then got some more memory. If we got all our memory at once, we wouldn't have this problem, right? We needed to be holding resources while waiting for more. With our like move file, we held one lock while waiting for the other lock. We need to have no preemption of resources. Preemption meaning that it can't be taken away from you. That basically you are infinitely stubborn and there's nothing stopping you from holding that resource forever. And we need to have an actual circular weight. So these are the things we need for deadlock, and we're gonna look at attacking each of these properties as options for avoiding deadlock. And which properties we'll get rid of was gonna depend on our scenario. And for locks, most of the time, we're going to focus on attacking this fourth property here. So before I do it, let's kind of review with locks. So here's a function that removes a node from a doubly linked list. And let's say we have a list. A goes to B, goes to C, goes to D, and so on. So we have our doubly linked list of A, B, C, D, E. And here I have some code that tries to remove a node, and this is susceptible to deadlocks. And I'm asking if we have these different sets of simultaneous calls, which ones could have a deadlock happen? I'll give you a little bit of time to look over that and check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what's going on. And so to make things clear, like in this design, B prev is A, for example. Would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A is the best? So I'll take, ask for the multiple choice answers, so we'll take the combinations. A is the best answer. B, C, D, okay, E, F, G, no clue, few no clues, and mostly D, which is the answer I got, just D, and some for F. So probably the most straightforward thing is let's talk about why A can deadlock. And an observation we can make is that if A deadlocks, then C must deadlock, because we can, C is just A plus an additional thread doing something, and if that thread, you know, runs before everything or after everything, we still have the deadlock in the middle. And that's still gonna cause a hang. You know, it's still a deadlock. So let's look at why A deadlocks, and then we'll look at why doesn't B deadlock? Like, what makes it, how can we prove that B can't deadlock? So for A deadlocking, that's up here, so this is A, and this is going to be. So remove B and remove C. So if we look at the code, we do block X, you know, X prev, and then lock X next, right? That's what the code does. So for remove B, we're going to lock B, then we're going to lock A. And if we run this kind of in lockstep with remove C, we're going to lock B, and remove C is going to lock C. We're going to lock A, remove A is prev, and remove B is going to try to lock B, which it's going to wait for the remove C is going to wait for the remove B thread. And remove B is not going to be able to unlock B until it's done locking C. But it can't do that because C has it. So that's our deadlock. And we can kind of picture this as we have our, we have remove B, remove C, and we can say we have our remove C thread is, has the lock on C that remove B is waiting for. and remove B, has the lock on B that remove C is waiting for. And remove B also has the lock on A, but that's not actually relevant to the deadlock. It's not causing the deadlock. So that's why remove B and C cause a deadlock. So why doesn't our situation of remove B and remove D cause a deadlock? Well, if we think of the issue here is that there's only an overlap in C. So we're going to have remove D and remove B. I'll do this order. B and remove D. And these are both going to have some sort of arrow to C. And remove B is also going to use A and B. And remove D is also going to use E and D. And we can't make a loop with just one thing in common. It's not possible. So there's never going to be a deadlock in this case. Another way of viewing it is that if we think of what happens in remove D, well, we're going to lock D, and either if we lock C, well, that's going to keep remove B from running until we unlock it, but nothing's going to stop us from unlocking it, you know, locking it that remove B is doing. So if remove B runs here, then it's going to wait to lock, and then it's going to lock when we eventually unlock. There's no problem. And the opposite situation, if remove B, we're running remove B, we're going to have the same kind of idea with remove C, that remove B is going to lock B, lock A, lock C, and if remove D comes along, it can't possibly be doing anything which is going to stop remove B from going to the unlock. So there's no problem there. So questions on how I figured out that scenario A is a deadlock and scenario B is not? Okay, so as I said, we're going to apply these properties to avoid deadlock, and we can attack different properties here. So one thing we can do is we can try to get rid of mutual exclusion. So if we have infinite resources, so in the case of something like memory, that's something we can do. We can have effectively infinite memory. You know, in that case, the allocator wait, not a problem, right? We don't have mutual exclusion anymore. We don't have to wait, you know, there's no taking turns needed. Or we can have no shared resources. If every thread has their own directories, there's no deadlock because no threads are sharing directories. These first two solutions, they work for some things, like that memory case. They don't work in most cases. But they get rid of deadlock because they get rid of mutual exclusion. Another idea is we can attack the hold and wait or no preemption idea. So one way of doing this is that we can say, well, instead of waiting forever for a lock, let's give up. So the way this would work is that we're going to, that there's actually a positive interface for this called trilock. So the way we'd use that is we'd probably, like if we're locking A and B, we'd lock A. I'll write this in without the full names of the function. So we'll lock A and we'll try lock B, and we'll have some sort of loop actually. So we'll do lock A, if try lock B fails, then unlock A. And just keep doing that until both locks work. So that would be the sort of pattern that we try to get the lock, try to get a new lock. If that doesn't work, we undo everything and restart from the beginning. So that idea avoids the hold and wait, and it works. The big problem with it is it avoids deadlock, but it doesn't avoid stalling. We can have a new form of stalling that's sometimes called live lock, where we keep trying over and over again forever. So an example of this, if we think of the dining philosopher's problem, one way this might manifest is if, let's say, we implement this solution where we try to get the lock. So the way we'd implement that is that we'd first, every philosopher would get their left chopstick. Then everyone would try to get their right chopstick. And when that doesn't work, we're going to abort and retry. So we're going to put down our left chopstick and do it again. And what's going to happen when we do it again? Well, probably a lot of the time, we're going to pick up the left one again and have the same situation recur. So in the lab, we're going to have a way of avoiding this, kind of, but where we're going to randomize how much we wait. But if you don't do something like that, you know, this doesn't solve the problem as well as you'd like, because you're kind of relying that if I try again, the deadlock randomly won't happen. And there's no real guarantee of that. Another thing we can do is we can say, you know, I'm going to forcibly take that resource from you. So in the dining philosopher's case, you know, I got the left chopstick, and I just say, give me your chopstick to the person on my right and take it from them. And, you know, we can actually implement versions of this. This is a little tricky to do, but this is actually the solution that's used by many databases. Many databases will have this thing where when they would have a deadlock, they'll instead choose one of the threads involved in the deadlock to give up the locks and undo what it was doing and try again later. But obviously, this needs a lot of bookkeeping to make that work. For a database, this is worthwhile, partly because you're already doing most of the bookkeeping for reliability reasons. But for our normal programs, we won't do that. So the solution we're going to typically use is this acquiring the locks in a consistent order. And I'll talk about that in a second. We also have this other solution where we can just get all the resources at once. So in the case of our directory locking, if we could just make sure that we get directory A and B together, there's no problem, because then there's no one can squeeze in between. So if we get all our resources all at once, there's no hold and wait anymore. And we can simulate that, and this is something you'll do in the lab, by sort of having threads take turns getting all their resources. So no thread gets resources in the middle of another doing it. This sometimes is viable for cases where we get all our resources at once. In many real situations, it doesn't work out so well, because you want to get some resources, do some computation to figure out what else to do, get some more resources. Not a good solution for that case, because you want multiple threads to do that at the same time. So let's talk about getting this consistent order idea. And this gets rid of the circular wait, because for a circular wait, if we have a consistent order, kind of, if I'm drawing my picture, all my arrows are in the same direction. Right? The reason we had our deadlock scenario is that one thread was doing A then B, while the other thread was doing B then A. If everyone does A then B, we'd have no problem. So we can just choose an order. So for our move file, this fixes that we just choose some directory to go first. We just have to choose an order that's consistent every time. So here, I've just chosen an ordering. It doesn't matter what ordering I choose, as long as I always choose the same one. So I can just like compare pointers, I can compare names. As long as it's the same ordering every time, I've prevented the deadlock. And this is, in fact, kind of the most frequent deadlock prevention technique that's used in sort of real software projects. So for example, here are some comments in the Linux kernel saying, this is the order you acquire these locks in. That you first acquire the LDT user semlock, then the mmap semlock, then context.lock. Never any other order. So this is like kind of the most common deadlock prevention technique, where we just agree on these rules for writing our code, that's always the order our locks are acquired in. So we know there's no deadlock. Okay. So that's where I'll finish up today. We'll finish up maybe a few things about deadlock next time and start talking about some other synchronization constraints.